Well, this was the plan of my talk, and the bits in grey are where I got to yesterday. So you can see I'm going to have to speed up infinitely if I want to cover everything. Probably by the end of this morning, I'll be talking so fast you won't be able to understand what I'm saying if you ever did. But let's... Okay, so we've got as far as talking about alpha suppression. And I predicted that would be a big argument. So, but we are having a discussion at 2 o'clock this afternoon on this very topic. So if we can postpone the big argument till then, I'd be very happy, because I have to get through this very quickly. But what do we really, really need to do if you want to understand alpha suppression? Of course, we have to solve the induction equation for the fluctuating field B. And we now have to solve, if we really want to do it properly, we have to solve the momentum equation for the small-scale flow, U. If we really want to understand how the field acts back on the flow, we have to do that. So we have to solve for U, we have to solve for B, and then calculate alpha and beta. I'm not really going to talk about beta, via, of course, U cross B averaged. But what do people do? Well, they do one of two things, as in the linear case, they do two things. They make some analytical progress in one of three or four ways. Oh, I put two there, okay. But one of three or four ways by doing one of the following. And they always do this. Exactly what they do is slightly different. But this is something that they always do. They take some exact results. There are some exact results. But these exact results that they have are almost always a consequence of the induction equation. So these are exact results either from Ohm's law here. I'll just go through them. There's an integrated form of Ohm's law here, which is just taking basic Ohm's law, dotting things around and averaging over the small scales to get this integrated form of Ohm's law. Again, I'm not going to go into details. They either do that, or they take this, again, exact result. This is a result for conservation of magnetic helicity in the small scales. This is done by deriving an equation for small scale A and small scale B, and dotting them together and averaging. And again, this is an exact result. And this is interesting because you notice this doesn't depend on diffusion at all. So that's another possibility. There are interesting terms here, which I don't really have time to go into. These things will turn into... or can be turned into surface terms when one does the integrals, okay? Or they consider some other exact results, and a very nice exact result which you'll hear people arguing about a lot is conservation of magnetic helicity and how this may affect alpha quenching. So this is the total magnetic helicity in your domain, and it can change only due to two effects. One is due to essentially resistive effects. So this term is proportional to eta, or at least it looks like it's going to be proportional to eta. So for a perfectly conducting fluid, this term will go away. Or magnetic helicity can leave the domain. Okay? These are two effects. These are the only two effects. And in the absence of either of those two effects, magnetic helicity is conserved. So what people do is they take either this result, or this result and this result, or some combination of the two. You can see that if one ignores these terms here and one assumes that everything's stationary, then one gets the interesting result that E dot B averaged is equal to naught. One can put this into here and relate J dot B to alpha, essentially. And that's an approach taken by Pat and Gruzinov. So they take one of these exact results, and then they combine this with, I have to say this, an inexact result. This result is not an exact result. This is an approximate result. This is a very famous result. You've seen it all at this meeting. This is the result by Pouquet, Frisch and Lehrer in 1976, which relates alpha to the kinetic helicity and this B dot J, the current helicity. Okay. And this is an approximate result in the nonlinear regime. One can see that really alpha is, of course, the average of U cross B. And we've managed to get it here by, in terms of U dot omega and B dot J, with a correlation time out the front. Now, I think most people looking at this result will realise it's not exact because it does have this, you know, correlation time at the front. The problem one has is that once this is combined with the other results that are exact and some more approximations made, then one can get rid of this tau correlation and look at something which looks like is an exact result. So I think there should be a warning on papers, you know, may contain Pouquet Frisian layer, like, you know, may contain nuts, you know, that you find in things. If it contains this, then you have to be aware that this is not an exact result. And this is, I think, the crux of the matter. One really needs to know how the field acts back in the Navier-Stokes equations. And one can write down this formula, but you have to be aware that it's not exact. You have to be very careful, and
I know you want us to hold the fight, but I would plead absolutely guilty as charged to inexactitude, but the crux of the issue, I would say, is what tau c means.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And is it the same, for example, for openers through the field and the fluid? Things
yeah.
Like that. It's not really the feedback.
I'm not saying that this is not interesting, and I also say I agree with you. The crux is when one has a magnetic field that acts back on the turbulence, how does this thing change? We all know that magnetic fields give a memory to the flow that wasn't there in the kinematic regime. This is something from Mike's paper, and I don't think very many people really understand what Pouquet, Frisian, Lehrer actually did. But if you don't, then I would recommend you read this paper, which is in the Proceedings of the Douglas Fest, edited by Mike Thompson and Jan Christensen Dalska. This is what they do. So just so you can see, it's not really an exact result. Pouquet, Frisian, Lehrer, they take a state of pre-existing helical MHD turbulence. Notice it's helical MHD turbulence, so you might expect it to have an alpha effect with a mean field. But they take a state which is pre-existing, it's happily minding its own business, as I said there, and it has a small-scale B and a small-scale U, but no large-scale field. And I put a question mark there because I'm not quite certain why it doesn't. They then add a weak field B bar to this and linearise the equations that they get. So they've had a small-scale field and a small-scale flow, add a mean field to it, which you can do, and if the mean field's weak enough, so this is a weak mean field, you can do a linearisation to get equations for the perturbations to U and the perturbations to B, which I'll call U prime and B prime. So U prime and B prime are the perturbations to the small-scale fields that you started off with. Once you've done that, you get these equations, and they then make the usual short correlation time approximation and linearize. You notice here there's no terms that look like U prime cross B prime. They do the integral, they go backwards, and they get that result. Now, there's going to be a big argument. Can we have it this afternoon? That is what I believe from reading Mike's paper. Is Mike around? That is what they do. No, he's not around. Excellent. Blame Mike. Okay. By combining the two results, or similar results, those two results, you can get formulas for alpha and beta, such as this, or a formula for E. And this is one I've just taken at random, which is quite complicated. And depending on what assumptions you make, you can get Rm factors or not get Rm factors. And depending on whether you think the boundary conditions are important or not, you can get different contributions to the terms. And I'm not going to go into details. Suffice it to say that quite a lot of this approach does yield you factors of Rm in the denominator. So one could do that, or one could just solve the problem numerically, like we did in the linear regime. So these are some numerical results. You take a fully 3D calculation, you calculate E is U cross B, you go back, you solve for U prime, you solve for B prime in an imposed field, and try and find out how alpha varies as a function of B naught and hopefully Rn. And so if we choose our favourite flow, the infamous Galloway-Proctor flow, and do this, and this has been checked with other flows, Axel has done this with other flows, calculate the EMFs. So here are the EMFs, and again, you have to average for a long time before these EMFs settle down, so the averages settle down. When one does that, one gets this very famous picture, taken from Fausto and David's paper in 1996. This is alpha versus the mean field. And the diamonds are the calculated results. This, and then they fit two curves to this, one of which looks like alpha over 1 plus b squared, which is what you would expect if there's no Rm factor in there. And then here's one with an Rm factor in there. And their claim, which I think is pretty good, is that one of these curves fits the results better than the other. They claim that this one fits the results a lot better than that one. So this is some numerical evidence that alpha is catastrophically quenched. They then try to do, with Jean-Claude Tellen, the harder problem of looking at the dependence on Rm. Of course, if you go to higher Rm, you have to go to much higher resolutions. And it does seem as though alpha looks like alpha naught over 1 plus Rm to some power, where gamma is order 1. So these are the results for different b naught squareds with alpha as a function of Rm. Mike's just walked in. Hello, Mike.
Hello.
You missed me plugging your work.
Oh, good.
Okay, enough on alpha quenching. There will be a lot of talk about that this afternoon. So that's mean field electrodynamics, and you've seen that there are some problems with it, but I told you that 85% of the work that has been done in the mean field ansatz. And you can also play the same game on the hydrodynamics. So if one wants to go into details on this, you can see Günther Rüdiger's book. You can play the same sort of games on the Navier-Stokes equations. You can split the flow up into a mean flow and a fluctuating flow and parameterize the small-scale interactions in terms of the mean flow. So this is the sort of thing you could do. You can derive an equation for the mean flow, and there are these terms, these Reynolds stress terms, which you don't know. You would like to parameterize those in terms of the mean flow. And this is exactly what the lambda effect does. But I'm not going to go into too many details. Suffice it to say that any problems that you find for mean field electrodynamics, I think, are in here. And they're also probably multiplied because this equation is inherently nonlinear. And this is an inherently nonlinear term. So there's no even linear ansatz one can postulate, I don't think. Everybody knows that for turbulence, there's no real closure that relates to small-scale flows to the mean velocity. And I put this in case Keith was in the audience. I have this nightmare. I have this memory of my PhD viva when Keith Moffat came up to me and said, what do you think about the lambda effect then? And I didn't have any thoughts at all about the lambda effect at that point. And after a few calculations on the board, Keith told me you have to really worry about the Galilean invariance of the equations for the lambda effect. But I'm not going to go into that. Okay, so we've gone through mean field electrodynamics, and if you like, that's the conventional turbulent ways of producing poloidal field from toroidal field, this alpha effect. But there have been other mechanisms suggested, and we've seen some of them here, for generating a large-scale poloidal field from the toroidal field. Most of these mechanisms are dynamic, and they rely on having a large-scale toroidal field to start off with. So they don't kind of produce everything from small scales, I don't think. But you can produce a large-scale poloidal field from a large-scale toroidal field in the following way. So I think a very nice way of doing this is to generate the poloidal field via a magnetic buoyancy instability in connection with rotational shear. We've seen some examples of this. If one has a flux tube, be it thin or otherwise, and it wants to rise and twist in the presence of rotation, then that will give you a component of poloidal field from your toroidal field. And we saw this in action, in some sense, in Nick's talk. The twist was provided not by rotation, but by the shear. But if one thinks of the shear as being driven by a rotation, then it's the same mechanism. So we've seen that one, and if one has a strong layer of toroidal field at the base of the convection zone, then we might imagine that this is going to be an interesting effect. Another interesting possibility is an instability that occurs in the tachocline that I don't have time to go into, but there is, if one has a toroidal field and a toroidal flow, then it's possible that these two can be jointly unstable to an instability which is very similar to the Balbus-Hawley instability that one finds in accretion disks. It's a joint differential rotation and magnetic field instability. And if one has these two together in the Tacker clan, which we certainly do, then Gilman and Dick Patty show that this effect does produce a mean flow with a net helicity. Now, quite whether this is an alpha effect in the conventional sense, I don't think that's right. This really is a large-scale flow which just happens to have a net helicity. And they associate an alpha effect with that, but I'm not certain that's quite right. But it's certainly good at twisting field lines. I don't think it's quite right to call it an alpha effect. And the other possibility we've also heard about in Alan's talk happens at the solar surface. As I said yesterday, the active regions occur with a systematic tilt at the solar surface. And if one looks at the diffusion so there's a component of poloidal field there. If one looks at the diffusion of this poloidal field as the sunspots decay, and also the fact that the meridional flow that's at the surface tends to move this flux towards the poles, then this is a possible mechanism for reversing the poloidal field at the poles. So one has a poloidal field of one sign at the poles, some poloidal field being generated from the systematic tilt of sunspots, and then the meridional flow brings up the poloidal field of the opposite sign to reverse the polar field. And this is often referred to as the Babcock-Leighton mechanism. Okay, so I'm now on to the bit. I think I'm trying to say here, what do we have to understand to enable us to understand the solar dynamo? And ideally, we're going to want to get from here, we know there's some turbulent convection, and we know there's some rotation, and we're going to want to get to here, to the strong, large-scale sunspot field. And that, I see, is dynamo theory. We want to get from here to here and understand all the processes in between. So everyone breaks it down into bits, and as I said yesterday, all of these bits are in Sasha's talk, so you could go back and hear Sasha's talk and try and understand what's going on. The first thing we need to understand is, from rotation and turbulent convection, where do the large-scale flows come from? So where does the differential rotation that you see, that nice pattern that helioseismology tells us with a rotation constant on radial lines, what is it that's causing this? And what is it that's causing the meridional flow? Even if helioseismology can't tell us exactly what the meridional flow is, we might be able to get some theories that tell us what the meridional circulation looks like. And again, Sasha showed you some pictures of what the meridional circulation looked like in his calculations. Well, it seems likely that the combination of turbulent convection and rotation, so mainly the turbulent convection in the presence of rotation via the Reynolds stress term, will lead to a redistribution of angular momentum. And this is what I described earlier as the lambda effect. So in these blue boxes, I'm going to be putting the mean field, if you like, the mean field jargon for the effect you're seeing. So here we have convection and rotation interacting to give us differential rotation and meridional circulation. So we have to understand that. Once we have differential rotation and meridional flow, then I think this bit is very well understood. If we have a large-scale, say, poloidal magnetic field, then differential rotation will certainly stretch out the large-scale magnetic field via the omega effect to give us a strong, large-scale sunspot field. So that's, I think, very well understood. The bit that's not very well understood, which is a bit I've been talking about for the last lecture and a half, is coming up. If one has turbulent convection and rotation, then one can argue that one has small-scale convection that knows about rotation. So we have helical or cyclonic convection, which I've called U prime there. And this is where it starts to get complicated. If we also have a small-scale magnetic field B prime, then U prime and B prime can interact by this turbulent EMF E to give us a large-scale magnetic field. So if this works, then we're okay, we've got a large-scale magnetic field, and we have the alpha and beta and gamma effects. I haven't talked about the gamma effects. So here we have small-scale interactions giving us a large-scale magnetic field, but of course that's not the end of the story, because where does this small-scale field come from? Well, it can come from a small-scale dynamo. That's certainly one possibility. Or it can come from the turbulent amplification of this mean field here, of a mean field. Turbulent amplification of the mean field B with it interacting with the with the small scale convection can certainly lead to very, very large small scale magnetic fields. So already we're getting quite complicated, and I haven't put any back reactions in. So now I'll put the back reactions in. Oof. Okay, let's see what we've got here. Here we have the small scale magnetic field acting back on the differential rotation via the small via Maxwell's stresses. And this, I believe, is what Slasher was seeing in his convection simulations. The dynamo was equilibrating because the small-scale fields and the Maxwell stresses were inhibiting, if you like, the formation of differential rotation. And in the mean field jargon, this is called lambda quenching. Okay. One could also have, of course, the small-scale field interacting with the large-scale field back on the helical convection. And this, I think, somewhere, is alpha quenching. Here we go. And I've talked a lot about that already. Finally, if one does have a systematic, strong, large-scale field, then that, of course, with large-scale currents, that can itself drive large-scale flows. Very simply, it's just, in mean field parlance, it's just J bar cross B bar. Yeah, so it's large-scale fields, large-scale currents acting back. So here we have a large-scale field with a strong field acting back on the differential rotation, and incidentally, it probably should act back here as well. And this, in mean field parlance, is called the Malkus-Proctor effect. So I'm just trying to get everybody to speed. As you can see, this is what we would really like to understand, either by local computational models or by having a better understanding of the mean field coefficients. But I think it's fair to say that we don't really have a very good understanding of this. But we do some mean field modelling, okay? So, let's just pause for a minute and see where we are. I would argue that basic mean field models do give us something that's right at a fundamental level. And Bob said, why is it that these basic mean field models give us something that works so well? So it gives us migrating waves, oscillatory dipoles, etc. It gives us all of these things. And we don't have a deep understanding at all of the nature of the mean field coefficients. I think that's true. We're still arguing about the amplitude, the order of magnitude of the amplitude. Even we're arguing even more, and we will be this afternoon, on the dependence of these turbulent coefficients on the field strength. And we have little or no idea what the form of these things are in the Sun or the other stars. So given that this works well, but we don't really know much about the input parameters, what can we do to gain an understanding of the nature of the solar dynamo? Okay, so here I'm going to give a quick grammar lesson. I think mean field modelling is very much like split infinitives in the English language. Okay, I'm not going to explain what a split infinitive is, so anybody who would like to know should ask Nigel. He kept correcting mine when I was a student. But Fowler, who is an expert on English grammar, has this remark on the split infinitive, which people are fussed about. He says, the English-speaking world may be divided into, right, those who neither know nor care what a split infinitive is, those who don't know but care very much, those who know and approve, those who know and condemn, and those who know and distinguish. So there are five classes of people there who worry about, or don't worry about, the split infinitive, some of whom care very much but get it wrong. I think mean field modelling is very much like that, because I think the world can be divided into four categories, and people can put themselves into one of these categories. There are those who neither know nor care about catastrophic alpha quenching, and let's face it, guys, this is most of the population. I'm sorry. And they're probably right. There are those who know, I mean, they've been to enough meetings where we've discussed it all, but don't care. Some of these actually do dynamo theory, but still, okay. They don't seem to care. There are those who know and care, but they still do some mean field modelling. And I have to admit, I put myself into this category here. And then there are those who know and condemn, okay. And you guys, you know who you are. I don't need to name these people. Okay. I believe that we can still learn something from mean field models, even though there are certainly all of these problems with it. But I think there are two approaches, which Nigel came up with the terminology of illustrative versus imitative modelling. Okay. Now, illustrative modelling, I think, is a good thing to do. And what does one do for illustrative modelling? You investigate the properties of the equations that you're looking at and try to understand how these equations behave as the inputs are varied. I think that's a very valid thing to do. So you could ask various questions. I've just picked some off the top of my head here. And this is, you take the mean field equations as given, and you say, well, okay, what happens if I change things around a bit? How will this affect things? So, you know, how does lambda quenching affect the dynamo? How might dipole modes interact with quadrupole modes in the nonlinear regime? If you can find an answer to that question, which is robust in the sense that no matter what mean field model you choose, it still occurs, then I think we have made some progress in understanding the solar dynamo. What would be the consequences of catastrophic alpha quenching and various other ones that I've put down here? Okay. And I would like to, obviously you would like to know which, if any, of these results are robust in a sense that I will describe later on. I think that's a valid thing to do. This I'm not so sure about. This is imitative modeling. So here one tries to put as many effects as possible into a model to reproduce the features of the solar cycle, as many features of the solar cycle as possible. So here are a list of observations that one would like to match. Cycle length, amplitude, migration and magnetic activity, phase relation between poloidal and toroidal fields, all of the above. And then one has a lot of free parameters to play with. One has the alpha tensor as a function of r and theta and time, the turbulent diffusivity tensor, the meridional flow, what form of quenching one chooses. Do we choose catastrophic quenching, normal quenching, or dynamic quenching? Maybe we could put in another nonlinearity, such as the Malkus-Proctor effect, the lambda quenching, effects due to magnetic buoyancy. So I see this as a kind of inverse problem. You know, we know the observations. Can we pick alpha, beta, gamma, etc., so that we can match them? And I think the answer is always yes. We have enough free parameters here that we can always match the observations if we like. I made this claim at a summer school I was lecturing at that the sun could come up with a smiley face for its magnetic field tomorrow, and I would be able to match it with a mean field model. And I think that's true, to be honest. Now, one of these things has been nailed down by helioseismology. The differential rotation has been nailed down. Now, I have to say, I think this is a bad thing. I'm going to argue that helioseismology nailing down one of them has given us the confidence to go on and try and match all the other things with these other turbulent coefficients. And I think that that may be a false confidence, which we may be trying to match too much, I think. Okay. I will go back to what results I believe to be generic or robust, but let me just go through three plausible dynamo scenarios. And I stole this picture off Sasha because I know Sasha's is a fully convective calculation, but it is representative of one of the mean field scenarios that we're looking at. So in this distributed dynamo scenario, the poloidal field is generated throughout the convection zone by the action of cyclonic turbulence. That's exactly what one saw in Sasha's calculation. And the toroidal field is generated by the latitudinal differential rotation. We have some differential rotation in the convection zone. It's latitudinal differential rotation. So here we have an omega effect. Here we have an alpha effect. And no role is really envisaged for the tachocline. But one could see this omega effect interact with this alpha effect to see how the dynamo worked. And in this scenario, I think it's going to be the small scale interactions which are going to give the angular momentum transport. And again, that's what Sasha saw in his simulations. So there are certain pros and cons to this. The pro is that this scenario, such as it is always possible wherever convection and rotation take place together. All you need is cyclonic convection and some differential rotation, and one has this scenario. So, for example, in fully convective stars where you don't have a tachocline, then, you know, something like this has to be going on, I guess. The cons are, and Sasha showed this, computations show that it's hard to get a large-scale field, a very strong large-scale field. Sasha's mean field was very weak compared to his fluctuating field. Mean field theory would also seem to indicate that it's hard to get a large-scale field because this is just convection and it's hard to get around catastrophic alpha quenching. And this was known a long time ago. Buoyancy tends to remove the field before it can get too large from a convecting domain. So that's the first scenario. The second scenario is kind of interesting because it kind of marries together two, if you like, two different regions of the sun in order to get this to work. So we have an alpha effect. This is taken from Dick Patty's paper. We have an alpha effect that's localized near the surface of the sun via the Babcock-Leighton mechanism that I described to you earlier. So here we have some poloidal field. It's carried by a meridional flow towards the pole. Here we have it going towards a pole, and it tends to reverse the polar field. Okay, that is established. We can see the meridional flow at the surface, and we can see the poloidal field moving and cancelling. But we do know that the tachocline is the place where, or we believe the tachocline, well, we know that the tachocline is the place where the strongest radial shear is, and most people believe it's a good place for generating the toroidal field, because a strong shear is good for generating toroidal field. And so what these guys do is they have the poloidal field generated here, the toroidal field generated down here in the tachocline, and they connect the two via the meridional flow. So this is a meridional flow that they choose. It's towards the pole, the surface, and back towards the equator, towards the base of the convection zone. Of course, we only know the meridional flow from measurements in this region here, and so we really don't know what's going on lower down. One question you might like to ask is, how big might you expect this flow at the base of the convection zone to be, given that the flow at the surface is something like 20 metres a second? So that is an interesting question. Sasha also showed the pictures that he had for his meridional flow, and whether you believe Sasha's results or not, they certainly didn't look like this. Okay, the meridional flow is a lot more complicated. This dynamo will only work if the meridional flow takes its form. But no role at all. Everything happens at the surface or the tachocline, and nothing happens in between. So all that turbulent convection that's going on in between doesn't really do anything.
Does it mean the toroidal will be brought to the surface equator?
Yeah, both by buoyancy and by this meridional flow. Yeah.
Yeah, which we don't see.
No, that's right. So I think I've been through these. The pros and cons is, well, it doesn't rely on a turbulent alpha effect in any way whatsoever, so all the problems of alpha quenching have gone away. Another pro is that the sunspot field is intimately linked to the polar field immediately before, because you can see this flux gets brought to the pole, gets dragged down, and when it gets dragged out, it is very clearly linked to whatever was happening at the pole just before. The cons, I think I've been through, it does require a strong meridional flow at the base of the convection zone of exactly the right form. It ignores everything that's happening near the tachocline, so it ignores any magnetic buoyancy instabilities or any sort of alpha effect near the tachocline. And I think that this effect might be swamped by alpha effects closer to the tachocline. And it also relies on the existence of sunspots or active regions, or at least ephemeral active regions, to work. If we don't have the alpha effect at the surface, this dynamo switches off. And then you have to wonder how the dynamo might have carried on during the Maunder minimum. So that's something else that you might like to think about. Now, this scenario has been modified slightly recently. As well as having, so we still have the same meridional flow and the Babcock-Leighton mechanism working here. This again is taken from Dick Patty's recent paper. But one also has the alpha effect at the base of the convection zone that we talked about earlier, arising from the joint instability of magnetic fields and differential rotation. So they have a kind of belt and braces approach where if this one doesn't work, this one gets you out of the problem. So quite what the role of this this alpha effect is in this model, I couldn't really say.
How do these things couple the two hemispheres?
Sorry?
How do they couple the two hemispheres? Why don't you have two sides?
How do they couple it?
Yeah, within this thing. It seems like you could have a dynamo going on in the north and one in the south.
Yeah, you could. You could. And they'll only couple by diffusion across the equator.
And in fact, observations show that.
Yeah, observations show
that essentially the northern and southern hemispheres aren't in phase in general.
Okay, My final scenario is, again, I stole this picture from Nick. I always steal this picture from Nick. Is where everything happens at the base of the solar convection zone. So we're looking kind of in this region here. So the dynamo here, and this mechanism or this scenario, whatever, it was proposed by Parker in 1993 as a way of getting around catastrophic alpha quenching, I think. So what happens is that the dynamo is thought to work at the interface between the convection zone and the tachocline. And there's two effects going on, but they happen very close together, but they are separated. The toroidal field, the sunspot field, is created by the differential rotation in the tachocline. And again, I think that's very well understood. So, and it's also stored in the tachocline. So the mean toroidal field, the large toroidal field that one always worries about, is just stored down here in the tachocline. Okay. The poloidal field is created at the base of the convection zone by the action of cyclonic turbulence in Parker's picture, or you can think of it as being created by the interaction of magnetic buoyancy with rotation. But there's some sort of alpha effect working just above the tachocline in the lower reaches of the convection zone. So why is this an attractive scenario? Well, as I said earlier, this gets you round catastrophic alpha quenching, because remember, catastrophic alpha quenching works when the mean field acts back on your turbulence to switch off the alpha effect. So if you store all your mean field down here, all your large scale field down here, and have your alpha effect going on up here, then if the balance works, if there is a delicate balance in this scenario, let's not kid ourselves, if you can balance things up such that exactly the right amount of flux gets stored down here, and so there's not too much flux up here switching off the alpha effect, then maybe this scenario can work. And that's what Parker postulated in the kinematic paper. And he said this would work if the turbulent diffusion was also quenched with a factor of RMB squared. It's a very delicate balance. And there are pros and cons to this scenario as well. Well, I've been through these. The radial shear is a great way of producing the strong toroidal field. The stable stratification enables the field to be stored against the action of magnetic buoyancy for a longer time. So we can store the toroidal field down here, and this was noted a long time ago, even before we knew the tachocline, the strong radial shear was here. We can store the mean magnetic field, the toroidal field down here for a long time, and enable the shear to keep working on it for a long time. So that's okay. As I've said this, and this is something that's not really talked about a lot, but I think it's true. If one's worried about conservation of magnetic helicity, a lot of people are saying that the dynamo can only proceed by losing magnetic helicity through the photosphere by the solar wind, then one doesn't really need to do that, because this system can conserve magnetic helicity but keep the magnetic helicity of one sign in the tachocline and the magnetic helicity of the other sign in the convection zone. And so, you know, if we have all the large-scale magnetic helicity down here and all the small-scale magnetic helicity down there, then the small-scale magnetic helicity doesn't worry about the large-scale magnetic helicity. The cons are it does rely on a transport of flux to and from the tachocline. If we can't efficiently get the magnetic flux from the convection zone into the tachocline and vice versa, then this kind of dynamo cycle will switch off. So there's a very immediate problem as to how to achieve this. So one way I think is kind of easy. It's very easy to see how flux from the tachocline can get into the convection zone just via magnetic buoyancy instabilities. The less obvious way is how does flux get out of the convection zone into the tachocline. We've seen some simulations of magnetic pumping, and I believe that this is the overshooting convection, is the turbulent compressible overshooting convection, is the best way of getting flux out of the convection zone into the tachocline. But it's still, again, it's not clear that this will work all the time. And there is, as Parker noted, a very delicate balance between turbulent transport and fields. The other thing I would say is this: is that this scenario is pretty specific, right? We have to get all of these things working, and we've kind of painted ourselves into a corner. Paul?
If I raise another con, which is that we've heard that there's lots of radial shear at the base of the convection zone at about 60 degrees north. and a bit near the equator, but sunspots appear at about 20, 30 degrees north, where there's virtually no shear, basically.
Yeah, so I agree, and one has to understand the mechanism for getting the field from the base of the convection zone to the surface.
I'll answer this question in my talk.
Okay, I'll put that down as a con. Okay, but I believe this is a real con, as it were. We've painted ourselves into a corner here. This is going to work for the sun and maybe other stars with the tachocline. And whenever I give this talk to astronomers, they say, "Well, where's the tachocline in the galaxy? How are we going to get, you know, this a mean field approach to work in the galaxy? Or where's the tachocline in the fully convective star?" So maybe there's no problem with these things being dynamos, but if one relies on an interface dynamo to get us a strong, large-scale field, then one will have to argue that if one has a fully convective star, then one shouldn't have a strong, large-scale field. And Sasha's simulations show that you don't have a strong, large-scale field, but, you know, who knows? So we have painted ourselves a bit into a corner. Okay. Now, we're going to have a whole meeting on the tachocline, and I think this is a very, very interesting region of the sun. So at least in two of these scenarios, the tachocline plays a key role. It generates the toroidal field through shear, and it stores the strong magnetic field in a stably stratified layer. So if we can understand the dynamics of the tachocline, this is really of fundamental importance. So what we really need to understand is the dynamics of a strongly magnetized, with a strong magnetized layer, with a strong differential rotation and strong stratification. If we can understand this, then I think we're in business, and we're just starting to make progress in understanding about its formation and also its many instabilities. And hopefully at the meeting later on in the workshop, then some of these questions will be discussed. Okay, I've given you three scenarios, and you can take your favourite one, pick your favourite one. And I've given you some plausible explanations of why things might work in the solar dynamo. I want to talk about whether there are any robust results, what I believe to be robust results from mean field models, because I argued that it's still worth doing some mean field models if one can find some robust results. So as I said here, there have been an infinite number of mean field models. Are there any results that tend to occur kind of no matter what? And I know that I'm going to say something which I think tends to occur, and somebody's going to go, but in my mean field model this doesn't occur. But this is what I believe tends to occur. And you can do this in two ways. You can either look at the underlying mathematical structure of the mean field dynamo equations and kind of see, well, this equation has this feature, therefore it must have this feature. Something like the equations have a certain symmetry, therefore the solutions must have a certain symmetry, and in the nonlinear regimes, solutions of those symmetries must interact in a certain way, so one could go down that path. Or you could just do lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of calculations and see what happens. And over the past 30 years, we've been doing this, I guess. Okay, so this is kind of a summary of the last 30 years of mean field dynamo theory. So it's going to take a while. I'm only going to talk about alpha-omega dynamos. For alpha-omega dynamos, fields can either appear in an oscillatory or a stationary bifurcation. And I don't think it's well understood when one occurs and when another occurs, but it can be either in both. So one can get a steady mode or an oscillatory mode. And steady modes, I think it's fair to say, are favoured when the alpha effect is more prevalent. The length scale of your dynamo wave, whatever it is, or your dynamo solution, tends to be of the order of the region of generation. So if one has generation in a thin layer, such as the tachocline, then the length scale of the field you get tends to be of the order of the thickness of the tachocline, unless you can bring some other effects to bear. This is a problem for just generating the field in the tachocline. The tachocline is very thin, but one has quite a wide wide sunspot belts. So one length scale seems to be a bit longer than the other. So I don't think one can just generate the field just in the tachocline. Dynamo waves, this is interesting, and this goes back to the 70s, to Yoshimura. Dynamo waves, if one has some wave, some oscillatory solution, they tend to follow lines of constant rotation. So therefore, given the differential rotation pattern, if they were generated in the convection zone, they would propagate radially, kind of bounce up and down, or they may be steady there, actually. But if they're generated in the tachocline, then they would propagate latitudinally. So maybe this is a piece of argument to say that the dynamo waves are generated somewhere towards the tachyon. I've said this already. For oscillatory modes, if D is less than 0, the fields tend to migrate towards the equator, although this is not always the case. Joanne Mason has found some very strange modes, which if D is negative, migrate towards the pole. If one does have a meridional flow of about 1 meter per second near to the base of the convection zone, then you can change the direction of propagation of dynamo waves. So even if the dynamo number is greater than 0, and the fields would like to propagate towards the poles, then having a meridional flow, which is pushing the dynamo wave towards the equator, will tend to overcome that tendency for things to go towards the poles. Okay, going into the nonlinear regime, the amplitude of dynamo solutions, the energy in the mean field, tends to increase. It usually increases as the dynamo number increases. The dynamo number minus the critical dynamo number increases. This is, I think, a robust result. And initially, B squared increases rapidly, and then the amplitude saturates. And this should remind you of what we saw in Andrew Collier Cameron's talk, with as we increase the rotation rate, magnetic activity tended to rise, and then it seemed to saturate, and then there was this very dodgy kind of super saturation, which we didn't really understand. But
why linearly? Exponentially?
Oh, this is a non-linear. This is a non-linear dynamo. Okay, so it's equilibrated, and then you say, what is the final amplitude of solution?
You've assumed the supercritical.
Yes, thank you. I've assumed the supercritical. Yes, I knew somebody would say, yes, but okay. I didn't think it'd be Nigel, though. I mean, come on, give me a break. Okay, as the dynamo number increases, the solutions tend to become more irregular. And there's a sequence of bifurcations that leads to chaotic solutions in general. So when one's just above critical, one tends to have nice periodic solutions. As you increase the dynamo number more, they become maybe doubly periodic, and that seems to be fairly robust. And then maybe there's a transition to chaos as the dynamo number increases. And as Razor showed last week, this is also a robust feature, I think, that the solutions tend to fragment in space and time. One can think of it as a spatio-temporal fragmentation of solutions. So as one goes more nonlinear, the solutions become more complicated. Okay, these I think are not quite so robust, but still robust. These are just what seems to happen, what you seem to need, what ingredients you seem to need to get things right. In the absence of a strong meridional flow, it appears that you need your alpha effect localized fairly close to the equator to get the dynamo to work, i.e. to get the active regions in the right place. And there's a number of authors, all of whom are in the audience, who have found this, so that's okay. In the absence of meridional flow, any alpha effect that's near the tachocline will swamp an alpha effect that's close to the surface in generating the magnetic field in conjunction with the tachocline radial shear. The addition of transport effects, for example magnetic buoyancy or pumping, as well as these meridional flows, they have a very significant effect on both the cycle period and the phase relation of the dynamo. It's no use saying I've got the phase relation correct, therefore my model must be great, because if you change transport effects like the alpha effect or the gamma effect or something, that will have a very significant effect on your solutions. Stochastic effects can be important, although I'm not going to talk about this. Usually when the field is weak, stochastic effects can be important. This is a picture I took from Paul Bushby's thesis, and it shows a mean field dynamo working quite nicely, but I think quite a lot of dynamos that use realistic differential rotation profiles are finding this these days, that in addition to the equatorial branch of dynamo waves migrating towards the equator, they also see a polar branch of dynamo waves migrating towards a pole. And this is because the radial differential rotation has changed sign from here to here, so the dynamo number has changed sign. But this branch tends to be weaker than this branch. So this may explain why we don't see this branch at the surface. If these fields are not large enough to make it to the surface, then we might not see this branch at the surface, even if it exists. The this is a very technical point, but the fact that one's doing dynamo solutions in a bounded domain, the fact that the dynamo knows that there is a north pole there and it is an equator there, means that dynamo action is always harder to excite than for basic waves. That's a bit of a technical point, so I won't go into it. But I think this is interesting. The frequency of the dynamo waves, remember we were talking about dynamo periods in the nonlinear regime, it really is a sensitive function of the amplitude of the solution and the boundary conditions. So this is not really a robust result, it's a kind of negative robust result. Sensitivity of the frequency always seems to be a feature of dynamo models. And the frequency rapidly moves away from that of the kinematic eigenfunctions. And I think this is a problem when one's trying to relate stellar dynamo periods, which one can do, twisting the knobs, as Bob called it, to dynamo calculations. This is a problem because one is really considering something that's nonlinear. And I think this is where nonlinear effects, even though the solution may look like it's linear or kinematic eigenfunction, I think this is where nonlinear effects might be very important in changing the frequency of the waves. Okay, this is, again, one can get robust results. In the nonlinear regime, remember I said kinematically one can get dipoles or quadrupoles. How do these interact in the nonlinear regime? Well, I believe it's a robust feature from all mean field models that the dipoles and quadrupoles can interact nonlinearly via the Lorentz force to produce mixed modes. So they can produce modes that are neither symmetric nor anti-symmetric about the equator. So these are mixed mode solutions. And not only can they interact, but they can interact in an interesting way for sufficiently large dynamo numbers, yielding doubly periodic and chaotic solutions. So this, I think, is the first paper that sees these things. This is a kind of beat between the dynamo dipole mode and the dynamo quadrupole mode. If they occur with a similar frequency in the kinematic regime, then one can get modulation of the solution in the nonlinear regime on a time scale that is the beat frequency between the small difference between the linear frequency. And that is seen in very, very many dynamo models. So I think that is a robust result. In the nonlinear regime, any sort of dynamic nonlinearity you have, for example, if you choose the Malkus-Proctor effect or lambda quenching or a dynamic alpha effect, this also automatically leads to a modulation of the basic cycle. And here I've got an example from Pippin, 1999, who uses the lambda effect, but I could have taken very many of these, where you see here we have the basic cycle that's modulated on a longer time scale. Okay? And the reason that this automatically leads to modulation of the basic cycle is because another time scale is introduced to the problem. There's a time scale of the nonlinear response to the driving from the dynamo wave. And there's a continual exchange of energy between the mean field and mean flows in this. So one can think of these things as relaxation oscillations between the energy in the mean field and the energy in mean flows. Okay. And I like showing this picture because it's kind of neat. The two modulational effects can interact to lead to very, very complicated spatiotemporal dynamics. Here's some solutions where we have both the two sorts of modulational effects that I was talking about earlier. Here we have a dipole and we have a modulational effect. We go into what I like to call a Maunder minimum for obvious reasons. And we emerge, interestingly enough, when we emerge we have a field of just one sign here. Sorry, not field of just one sign, field in just one hemisphere. So this is the symmetry breaking that one saw in the sunspot data. And the dynamo can proceed. Another interesting feature is that because dipoles and quadrupoles are very close to each other in the linear regime, one could imagine an instance where one goes into a Maunder minimum with a dipolar field and emerge with a quadrupolar field. And this is called flipping, or has been called flipping of the field polarity. Again, if one has a dynamic nonlinearity, such as the lambda effect or Malkus-Proctor effect, one tends to get torsional oscillations generated by these dynamic nonlinearities. Again, this is taken from Paul Bushby's thesis, where he has an interface dynamo working at the base of the solar convection zone, which drives a large-scale flow via the Malkus-Proctor effect. Where you get the actual torsional oscillations is a very sensitive function of where the magnetic field is generated. So here he's changing the stratification in his model. Remember, everything's been driven at the base of the convection zone, and as he makes it more and more stratified, he can see torsional oscillations, first of all, appearing at the base of the convection zone, But as it makes it more and more stratified, despite the fact that the driving is at the base of the convection zone, the response via the torsional oscillations is at the surface. That's an interesting result, I think. Okay, I'm not going to talk about those. Predictability. If one reads the popular press, or New Scientist, but I don't think that's that popular, we've nearly solved the solar dynamo problem, and we're just about to go on and predict what's going to happen in the future. So what has been done is to train a dynamo model, a mean field dynamo model, and to get it right over two cycles. And then to say, I'm going to be able to predict from my mean field dynamo model what's going to happen next. Now, I think there are two reasons why this is not such a good idea. One is that I believe that the solar dynamo is naturally chaotic, so given the fact that it is chaotic, making predictions is going to be quite difficult. And the other is that we understand the input parameters to such a low level that I think making predictions is hairy, to say the least. And this is just something that I persuaded Paul to do, is to take three mean field dynamo models, actually we're taking about 12 of them, with very slightly different input parameters. The input parameters never vary by more than 3%. Now remember, we're arguing about an order of magnitude in the alpha effect. So we have about 5% difference in the parameters. We then train them over two cycles, as it were. We get the solution right over two cycles, and then we see what happens and how good a prediction would be in the future. And I think you'll say that, you know, it's not very easy to predict what's going to happen, even one cycle
in the
further on.
Future work.
This is future work. Yes, Paul's still doing a few more runs. So yeah. So. Yes, thank you. So I predict that this will come out in 2005, but I could be wrong. Given the nature of... oops, wrong way. Okay. Now, I was going to say a bit more about global computations, but Gary's going to talk a bit, and Sasha's already said a lot. But I think this is a very interesting picture that Sasha showed. So this is really... I'm going to try and relate this back to the mean field theory. So what Sasha showed us was an example of a distributed dynamo. And as he showed this picture, he showed us that the mean energies that he could find in convection were a lot smaller than the fluctuating energies. And this is exactly what one might expect from mean field theory. So it's very hard to see, or it's not clear, how the dynamo works to generate a large-scale field. And I believe that it's only through the tachocline that we're going to be able to understand how a large-scale field is generated. Interestingly enough, the dynamo equilibrates by extracting energy from the differential rotation via the small-scale Maxwell stresses, which is what one might expect for a fully convective dynamo. And this is an example, if you like, of lambda quenching in action. So that's just relating Sasha's work back to mean field theory. Okay, Sasha's talked about that. Okay, I'm going to finish in the last 3 minutes. Most of what I've talked about, of course, is applicable to other stars as well. But there has been some specific modelling of other stars. And some progress has been made in describing dynamo action in three other classes of stars, I would say. There might be more, but I'm not aware. So solar-type stars, of course, we can use our solar models to have a look at how solar-type stars might behave in rapidly rotating stars and in fully convective stars as well. Now, I'll just say something about fully convective stars. I believe that fully convective stars must act in the way that Sasha showed for a fully convective spherical shell. I don't see how, if one believes catastrophic alpha quenching, one can get a strong mean field in fully convective stars. So using the mean field, I think you have to really worry about using mean field theory in fully convective stars if one doesn't put in catastrophic alpha quenching. Okay. In solar-like stars, what people try and do is they try to use the observations to calibrate their dynamo models. So they try and look at how the cycle changes and how the amplitude changes, and then try and do a kind of inverse problem to say, therefore, alpha must behave like this or that or the other. I think this is very, very difficult to do because the results are really very sensitive to the assumptions that you put in the model. So taking some data and putting them and tuning it to a model, Axel and Steve Saar found that alpha should scale like b to the n, where you see n is some positive power. I mean, not very well defined positive power, but a positive power. this seems to indicate that alpha is increasing with B. Given that for 50 minutes I've been arguing that it either decreases slowly or decreases rapidly, here's a result which seems to indicate it's increasing with B. And eta also has a dependence on B. But I believe that these results are very sensitive to the assumptions that you put in the model, because as I said earlier, I think frequency or period of dynamo waves changes in solar dynamo models for two reasons. One is a change in the dynamo wave speed, how fast the wave likes to travel. The other is due to a change in length scale. And that change in length scale, as one changes the critical dynamo number, is not very easy to capture, and it seems to be kind of model dependent. So here I did lots and lots of runs at different with different nonlinearities to see how the dynamo period behaved from the dynamo number. And you can see that each nonlinearity and each change in the model seem to give a different dependence of the frequency on the dynamo number. But interestingly enough, I think this is an interesting plot that I don't really understand. When I plotted the difference in the period from the linear period against the amplitude of the solution, this is a kind of wacky plot, all of those different nonlinearities, alpha, some were alpha quenching, some were Marcus Proctor, some were whatever, eta quenching, they all collapsed onto two lines with a given slope. So it seemed that the frequency, or the period, was a very sensitive to the amplitude of the solution, with a dependence where it looked like b squared to the power of 1. So the deviations in the frequency always took the same form. That's something I don't really understand, I have to say. Finally, if one takes rapidly rotating stars, one might imagine that, again, this is taken from Paul Bushby's thesis, one might imagine that the differential rotation looks more like a tail, as dictated by the Taylor-Proudman theorem, constant on cylinders, and here he's put in a tachocline as well. We've heard that differential rotation is likely to play less of a role because delta omega over omega is smaller than for the sun, although Andrew said this was a very stupid thing to think about, but yeah, oh well, okay, we're thinking about it. It's much smaller. We might imagine that differential rotation is less important. And what sort of results does one expect from a mean field model looking at rapidly rotating stars? Well, Paul found that where the tangent cylinder plays an interesting role, it tends to wipe out solutions at low, mid to low latitudes and favour solutions at high latitudes. And this is meant to be reminiscent of kind of polar spots. It's also important to say that, of course, for rapidly rotating stars, not only is the dynamo more likely to be of alpha squared omega type, it's also alpha is itself more likely to be a tensor than it's going to be highly anisotropic. Okay, I've talked about fully convective stars, so I'm not going to say that. So let me finish by speculating a bit. I still don't really have an answer to Bob's question why mean field theory works so well. I don't know. But I do really believe that it is telling us something about what's going on in the sun and other stars. I think what we need to do to work at is to constrain the input parameters. And of course this requires a full understanding of MHD turbulence. We need to understand the turbulent alpha effect. This is something I haven't even talked about, but I think is a really fundamental problem, the turbulent diffusion of a magnetic field in a turbulent layer. And we need, from helioseismology, to get a better measurement of the mean flows. Of course, we're going to be doing more and more computations. We can do small-scale computations, which maybe will impinge on how the turbulent alpha effect or turbulent diffusion changes. Or we could do the types of calculations that Sasha was talking about, large-scale, to try and get an understanding of the global dynamics. And I think it's fair to say that we can actually learn a lot from the mathematical structure of these equations. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. About 5 minutes for discussion. Please.
Yes, Steve. Actually, I agree about what you said on the simulation we are doing. But I think it's problem of the simulation we are getting is that we are not getting a toroidal field that is as strong as what we are seeing in the sun. But for the poloidal field, it's less clear that we are not getting it right. It's more the ratio of the two that seems to be off compared to what we are getting in the sun.
And that's because you don't have a tachocline, I think.
Yeah, I don't have a tachocline. So I agree with you that in a fully convective star, what we will certainly get is not a cycle as we are seeing in solar-type stars with a tachocline, and certainly a ratio of toroidal to poloidal field that is closer to one than what we are seeing in the sun. That's
and what about the ratio of mean to fluctuating field as well? You think the mean field in a fully convective star is going to be much smaller than the fluctuating field?
It will still be small, the mean field, yes, but I mean the ratio between themselves, the toroidal and poloidal component, will certainly be closer to each other.
I agree with that, yeah.
I have a comment, Steve, on the tachocline. I really think we should be talking about two tachoclines.
Oh, dear.
When you look at the solar differential rotation profile from helioseismology, you see a fairly strong tachocline in the polar regions with d omega dr negative. You see a somewhat weaker tachocline near the equator with d omega dr positive. And then in mid-latitudes, there's no tachocline at all. The differential rotation is very gradual, and it's actually primarily in the latitudinal direction. And I think, you know, it's perhaps just semantics, but I think it clarifies the thinking, because as the solutions to mean field show, you can have two dynamos, one propagating near the equator, another near the poles.
I would agree with that.
It's a comment and a question, which is, the comment is I wanted to give you a resounding thumbs up for actually giving two words of mention to the question of turbulent diffusion. as you quite correctly noted, people love to fight over alpha quenching, and it fascinates me. I've been deliberately keeping my mouth shut on this subject,
except in private.
And no one of this learned audience, until your two words, has actually mentioned beta quenching.
It's because it's very hard, Pat.
I want to remind people of it. And it's also hard, and it's also probably more important.
Yes.
Because, I mean, not only is it the role in the mean field theory, but it really strikes at the heart of, in a sense, irreversibility and turbulent reconnection that everyone appeals to and nobody understands.
Yeah.
And the other comment in that regard is that, you know, the interface dynamo is a dead duck beyond a certain degree of beta quenching.
As I said, it's a very delicate beast.
But how much is understood about the effect of magnetic fields on overshoot? That's the question.
Nick, where is he? How much is understood on the...
Not much.
Not much. There you go.
Two comments. One has to do with the point that you made at the end about fully convective stars. One thing that you need to also fold in is the fact that precisely because of the argument that you made, there was an expectation in the early 80s that when one does a survey of late-type stars going down to M5, so just the place where classical stellar structure theory would say that stars become fully convective, that you would see a change in attributes of stars, X-rays or... properties in the radio. So, you know, when you go down the main sequence to low mass stars that become fully convective, and you use the activity diagnostics, there's absolutely no hint that the stars are becoming fully convective. So, question.
Yeah, it raises a serious question.
Yeah. The other point that I wanted to make is I think you're shortchanging the prediction avenue.
That
represents. And the reason is the following. I think it's very interesting that she, of course, is at NCAR, is of course the home of folks that do weather prediction.
Mm.
People that do weather prediction are exactly in the same boat.
And they don't do very well, do they?
And they do something else, which we don't do, which is they do something called data assimilation. Right? They would never, in a million years, do what you did, which is to try to predict that many cycles in advance, because they know a priori that you'll get nonsense.
But even one cycle ahead, you're not going to get the right answer.
Well, that depends on how well you've parameterized the solution.
It does.
One interesting question from the point of view of prediction, as opposed to understanding, prediction, they're different, is it, can you parameterize the solution in such a way that you can in fact increase, you know, the time on which you can predict. And that's not a matter of trying to understand, but that's a matter of people who are interested in prediction. There are people that need to be able to predict.
My response to that is I agree, but I wonder what using a mean field model, you know, time series prediction or something like that. And I don't think it buys you anything.
No, but it's an open an issue.
I'm not saying it, yeah.
Marks. One is that Wright never had meridional flow in the time.
No.
It was only when a graduate student was asked to look at the model and measure diffusion, found that it was too small, mm-hmm. and predicted meridional flow. The other is to buy characteristics of magnetic fields from emission in the UV and X-ray regions. We've been doing modeling. We found that the heating of loops is essentially, as Bob suggested, proportional to B over L. If you take surface distributions of magnetic fields, you find that the correlation between B and L is essentially zero. And so you can distribution functions of L. And it turns out the distribution functions of L are almost independent of how field is distributed on the surface of the star. So you can bring up bipoles at random on a star, or you can bring up, just make B total zero and bring up magnetic field separately in one side or the other to field, get the loop length distribution, and you find out that it doesn't make any difference. So that it's looking at the EUV or X-ray emission from a star is not a distinguishing character.
Okay.
It doesn't, you know, it doesn't make any difference that you're looking at a fully convective star or a star with a lot of order.
Two short comments. You had a plot showing the cycle period increasing with field strength. Observationally, it decreases. It's the frequency which increases. Observationally. And I agree that...
No, the cycle period decreases, yeah. In the models, yeah.
But not in this and many other models.
No, in that model, right. The cycle
period... The other thing
decreases.
About Galilean invariance, the lambda effect is Galilean invariant.
It is. And, okay, you should have a conversation with Keith.
It was unclear. He left it as if people have done mistakes or something.
Okay, good.
Okay, Igor, short. Which are you?
Right. Oh, of course.
Okay. Your skepticism about the magnetic alpha effect is based on the very since this time development.
Okay.
There are other waves of derivation of nonlinear electromotive force which doesn't assume a small fluctuative field. Okay, maybe we'll
But do they all have a tor in there? They all derive that formula with a tor correlation.
Okay, maybe we'll discuss about
that. I think it's a problem.
At 2 p.m.
Yeah, 2 p.m.
Yeah.
Mike. I just want to make a completely different sort of point, which is that you've got a large, as you say, why does the alpha effect work so well? In fact, you've got huge numbers of models, completely different dynamical interactions, which show sort of propagation of waves and modulation and so on. It doesn't have to be the alpha effect at all. It's a sort of general property of oscillatory systems in finite domains.
Yeah.
And the fact that the alpha effect works well produce the butterfly diagram does not prove that it's right.
No.
Almost anything would work. I will produce a system, you know, based on any physics that will do that.
Yeah.
And even the physics is quite wrong. The outturn.